Hello and welcome to 251, Two Pianists, 5 Minutes, One Subject. And our subject today is jazz and civil rights. My name is Simon Whiteside.
And my name's Nick Tomlin, and this is 251. So Billie Holiday recorded the anti-lynching song Strange Fruit in 1939, and some people sort of point to this as really the beginning of jazz's involvement with the civil rights sort of struggle. I mean, I think really, in a way, this kind of protest element of jazz can really goes back to the beginning. I mean, the fact that jazz really grew out of slave music, and slave songs were a kind of protest. I mean, very coded, often by necessity, but they were a kind of protest against the situation that these people found themselves in, and that kind of continued really, but it's kind of in a sort of covert way. I mean, for example, I think bebop, I see that as a kind of political statement, although again it wasn't overt, but you know, in a way bebop musicians were reacting against what they saw as kind of the white establishment kind of using their music or adopting their music, and they were trying to kind of reclaim it to an extent. So there was a kind of political element, but it was kind of covert, and I think it only really became more overt towards the end of the 50s, and that's really when you get this kind of association between jazz and the civil rights movement in America. And Sonny Rollins recorded Freedom Suite in 1958 with Oscar Pettiford and Max Roach. And that was kind of, and from that point really, there was then quite a spate of recordings which were explicitly linked to the civil rights struggle. Mingus recorded Fables of Phoebus in 59. That was an attack on the Arkansas pro-segregation governor, Orval Phoebus. Max Roach's We Insist Freedom Now Suite, which he wrote with the songwriter Oscar Brown Jr., and that featured Abby Lincoln sort of singing songs about the legacy of slavery, but also the struggles and protests. And it's very political. I mean, there's a section in there where she's sort of screaming in sort of accompanied by Max Roach's drums, and it's quite a powerful statement. And it was overt. I mean, this was a political statement they were making, I think, at this point. Yeah, I don't know, Simon. What are your thoughts on?
Well, I think you've laid out a good background. I think the covert-overt factor is interesting because, as you know, I'm a big fan of Dan Burley. Do you remember me talking about him?
Yes, yeah.
And all of this stuff was being talked about in the black press, as it were, you know, like the New Amsterdam newspaper and things.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that it was hidden. It was just not in the white domain.
Yeah, sure.
And I think that bebop brought more power in a way to black musicians, and they played music and earned the living from music, and
yeah,
they weren't doing it in order to please a white audience.
No, they kind of took control of it in a way from there.
And I think that's where what we're saying about it becoming overt.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, of course, the rise of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X was enormously important. So there was also a political movement which they could bounce
off. In fact, Martin Luther King especially really acknowledged jazz. I think just the fact that you had these, you know, black musicians were, and they were respected artists, and they were making a statement, I think that was very powerful for the civil rights movement. And he often alluded to that, you know, in his speeches.
Definitely. And I think also, you know, you had that situation where Dizzy Gillespie ran for president, didn't he?
Yeah.
Whether how serious that was, I don't know. But they also sent bands out to on sort of cultural exchange, didn't they? Was it to Moscow they sent?
All over the place.
So it was becoming part of the American way of expressing themselves. But we're coming to the end of jazz and civil rights. Big subjects, small amount of time. My name's Simon Whiteside. Goodbye.
My name's Nick Tomlin. Goodbye.